And with a look into the backcountry from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, Drew Hardesty. Good morning.
Hey, morning, Leslie. You know, generally moderate danger for today. We'll have increasing winds, you know. Out of the south, ahead of the storm system, we'll have just areas of wind slab, predominantly along the high ridge lines, generally west, north, and east. Continued mention of deep slab instability, isolated areas. Generally, again, they're sort of west and north to southeast. Low probability, high consequence. Probably would take a significant trigger, such as the one from Monday along the high massif of Tampanogos. Matt Turley, he's a noted photographer. He was over in the Heber Valley, and you could see it from the with the naked eye. It's very large, natural cornice fall induced, we suspect. Probably 500 feet wide, 6 to 8 feet deep. And it's amazing. You got to check it out on the web. The photo's amazing. It went over a cliff band, cascaded down, triggered another old snow avalanche. A couple of them went over another cliff band, triggered another old snow avalanche. It ran probably 3,000 feet. Down into the Tempanuki giant staircase area. Again, it's worth a quick look on the web. We have it on the homepage there. So the danger is going to be on the rise, certainly, and may reach high, particularly in the Provo area mountains, getting on towards Thursday afternoon, evening, and into the overnight hours into Friday. So it looks to be a significant event that's going to shake up the avalanche world. Stay tuned. We'll see how the weather and avalanche conditions shake out.
Okay. Yeah, that picture. Oh, my gosh. It is. It's huge. Why? Oh, my gosh.
Tremendous.
Yeah. All right. Hey, Drew, thank you. The Park City Board of Education yesterday spent the majority of its meeting discussing the upcoming school year budget. In the studio with a recap of the meeting, I have School Board President Andrew Kaplan along with newly appointed Board Member Aaron Grady. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Aaron, we haven't had the opportunity to speak with you since you were appointed. So maybe just tell us a little bit about who you are, your background, and why you wanted to serve.
Perfect. Well, I grew up in Park City. I've been here for about 35 years. I stayed and actually had my career with Deer Valley Resort. I did the PR for them for about 13 years. And then after I had my second son, became a stay-at-home mom and just really got involved in all things kids, and just feel like it's a very important time to be involved.
Okay, so you're running out of post, so you will serve another 4-year term after this appointed term ends.
Yes, so 5 total.
Okay, as I mentioned, budget discussions dominating the board meeting yesterday. Extensive conversation about adding 4 new positions, 1 interventionist in each of the elementary schools. Aaron, you asked if we're trying to get back to what we had 3 years ago with our classroom aides for teaching. So did you get your question answered or learn more?
I think I've learned a little bit more, just kind of understanding. I feel like I sat in a meeting a few weeks ago with Dr. Einhorn and got a plethora of information and just have felt a little bit overwhelmed at the time. But I think we're slowly kind of working through that and understanding what the interventionists will be doing and the need for them in the full 4 elementary schools.
Yeah, Andrew, and we've moved to what's called this MTSS, this multi-tiered system of supports. How many tiers are there in this system of support?
So there's 3. The easiest way of describing it, tier 1 is normal classroom instruction. Tier 2 is a second dose of that classroom instruction for students who don't quite grasp the concepts the first time around. And then there's tier 3, which is for those kids who still don't get it with a second dose. There would be intervention or a very small group to teach it to them in a slightly different way.
So the second dose then is done in the classroom?
Correct.
So what are the other kids that get it doing?
It depends on the class and the subject. A lot of times it's, you know, during center time or, you know, the kids are working on they're doing other work. And then the teacher will get together a smaller group and go over things again. You know, there's dedicated time during the school day in the elementaries for that. You know, it's called different things at each elementary, but it's structured into the day to you know, help kids get up to speed.
So these interventionists at each of the elementary schools would be used specifically for the tier 3 children?
Yeah, that's what's happening. And there's, you know, we have at our schools, we have anywhere from 300 to 600 kids at the elementary schools. And at each school, there's one interventionist. So obviously, their bandwidth is limited. And if you have, you know, they're meeting all day long with children and, you know, for various periods of time, right? Some children get a minute or two a day. Some children get, you know, longer periods of time, whether it's a whole class period, et cetera. So it kind of depends on the severity of their needs and you know, where they need remediation. So
yeah. So are these students, tier three students, pulled out to meet with the interventionists, or again, is this being done in class?
So tier three, you know, it could be both, but it could either happen in the classroom or outside. You know, typically they're pulled out of a class for a few minutes at a clip to work on, you know, specific skills. And the concept really is, you know, we're trying to go away from pulling kids out of classroom instruction. You know, there's a lot of studies that show that, you know, taking kids out for extended periods of time of regular classroom instruction actually sets them back academically. And so the thought is that you try to give the teachers a larger toolbox of skills to help kids in the classroom and try to bring more services into the classroom rather than pulling them out.
And who are these interventionists? I mean, are they more than teachers? Or are they not even teachers? Or
they have a teaching certificate, and then they just have more additional training, whether it be Wilson Wirtz, Orton Gillingham, more kind of specific training for language and for reading development.
Yeah, you did hear from Kathleen Einhorn explaining how the interventions work. Andrew, it seemed like both you and Petra, however, didn't feel comfortable with the answer. So what do you feel like is missing from the intervention?
Well, I think we just have I think part of it is us as board members getting educated in terms of how the district works and how they look at things. But I also think there's a difference in ways of thinking between the way that the district has done things and the way that the board is looking at things. And what we want is a benchmark or a baseline to basically say, okay, here's how many kids we have in various grades with different learning disabilities, whether that is dyslexia, whether it's language acquisition, whatever it may be, and say, okay, what are we doing for these children? What are the services that we're providing? And then, you know, and have a benchmark and a baseline and then take it from there and watch the progress. And I think that a lot of this has been done on an ad hoc basis traditionally. I think part of that is that once you part of the issue is that once you test and identify children that have learning disabilities, you have a legal obligation to ensure that they're getting the correct services. And so traditionally in public education, that testing is a little bit lax because, you know, it can force the hand of a school district to go out and spend money and do different things. And I think we're coming to terms with the fact that we have no shortage of resource and we want to close the achievement gap for our students. We want to help all of the kids who have learning disabilities. We don't want our Latino students to get to the 12th grade and be well below the national average in terms of literacy and reading level and things like that. And so in order to do that, we have to have consistent testing across the district. And that's what we're having a dialogue with. And that's what we're going to work with the administration to get to.
Yeah. So where is that biggest achievement gap found? Is it in our ELL learners or is it the developmentally challenged learners?
I would say it's with ELL, and that's been consistent, I think, through the, you know, at least the recent history of our district. It's something that we don't have a ton of expertise in at the district, and I think we're going to be looking to add that expertise. It's interesting, you know, as the city looks at social equity and as a community we try to tackle these things, it becomes ever more apparent to us at the district that, you know, we also need to tackle these same issues. And so it's a collective community issue. And it's something that, you know, we're very fortunate in as a school district and that we're not strapped for resources, right? We don't have to make a decision. Do we help one kid or do we help another kid? We can help all children.
So these interventionists, a requirement would be that they're bilingual, I'm guessing.
Well, that's one of the things we're discussing, right? So the interventionists that were proposed to be hired were specific to reading specialists. The skills and the programs, you know, Aaron mentioned Wilson and Orton Gillingham and some of the reading focused trainings, those are not necessarily the same as the trainings that you would have to help with English language learners. And so that's one of the things that we're discussing is there's many, many different types of ways that students learn, and there's many things that students will struggle with, and every kid is different. And we need to make sure that we have the right people there for not only kids who struggle reading, but kids who struggle with language acquisition, kids who struggle with numeracy issues, everything, right? And that's what we're trying to do. And we're trying to figure out what is the right data to look at and what is the right benchmark so that we can actually assess this moving forward.
So I guess bottom line, Aaron, is will the budget line item for four interventionists improve the achievement gap? I mean, is that the question you need to ask yourself before you approve it? Or?
Well, I think it's something we definitely have to look at in making sure that we're placing them and not just putting bodies into spaces, but that they're going in for the right reasons and getting the right training and hiring the right people for those positions.
Yeah, and I think the board is, you know, it's this line item has brought up a larger kind of philosophical discussion. I don't think the board really cares about the number, right? It could be four, it could be 14, right? If that's the right number. I think what we need and what we need for, you know, to be, you know, good stewards of tax dollars is the data behind what this looks like, right? And know that we can monitor it and assess it going forward and so that we can all be accountable to the community.
All right, let's move on to start times. Yeah. The school board rescinded the motion to implement start times for this upcoming school year. So now what? You want to take that, Aaron?
So now we're looking at forming a committee that would start working on that in the hopefully sooner than later, and work on it with our master planning to move forward.
Yeah, so the you know, the issue is timing, you know, to get the scheduling correct, especially for the high school. A lot of that's done in January, and we've kind of missed that window for this fall. And so everything from the transportation schedule to the class schedule to dealing with extracurriculars and pre-care and aftercare and all the different things that get affected, you know, that has to be done by the end of this year. And, you know, the end of calendar 18 is what we're targeting so that we can look at it for 19. And really the direction that this board committee is going to take is we want to, you know, do something that if the majority of folks in the, you know, the majority of the parents and students and teachers in the high school, this is something they want to pursue, then, you know, it's something that we can implement there with the least amount of disruption for the rest of the district. We, you know, as a board, we're responsible to everyone in the district, and we have to recognize that, you know, we have half of the school district is elementary school, you know, another large percentage is middle school. And so if we change the start times for all of those kids and it's unacceptable for the parents and the community for those children, it's never going to work to change the start times for the older kids and who actually need this. So what we're going to try to do is just refocus, try to isolate it to the high school and to Treasure, and work with the different stakeholders to, you know, to figure out, okay, how does this affect extracurriculars? How does it affect transportation, et cetera?
Yeah, but I guess, I mean, is that something that hasn't already been done by the committee that made the recommendations in the first place?
Yeah, so where it kind of fell over last time was there was an implementation committee that was formed, which was the hope of the board was that they would look at all of those issues, and the implementation committee met once, and that was it. And then, you know, we kind of hit a roadblock around the transportation issue on 248. And so the combination of those two things, you know, halted it, and, you know, we're going to pick this back up and see if we can look at all of the issues, not just transportation, because, you know, there's certain things that there's other levers that we can pull, right? If we change the schedule at the high school, for example, from a block schedule to a period schedule, that may be a solution, or move professional development time around. There's all kinds of things, but obviously any of those conversations have to involve the administration, have to involve the new, you know, principal of the high school, have to involve the, you know, our athletic director, all the different stakeholders who, you know, the teachers union, obviously, and the teachers at the high school, to get everyone's input and make sure that we're not, you know, really, we're not forgetting something or messing something up on implementation. And it's a really complicated process for a simple problem.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, very, very earliest anything could happen would be the 2020-2021 school year.
No, I mean, the earliest would be the 1920 year. And that's only if we can resolve all of these questions by the end of calendar year 18. So, again, that's a tight schedule for this type of thing. But I think there's a will from some members in the community to make this happen. And the board is supportive of that. So if we can come to an agreement that works for everyone, then we're willing to look at it again. If we can't, then, yeah, obviously it would extend the time frame.
All right. So this time next month, you're expected to have 5 to 7 finalists for the superintendent's position. The application process is closed at this point?
No, the application process is still open. We will be meeting on April 17th to go over kind of the first cut of the candidate slate with our recruiter. And the first round of interviews will be the weekend of May 5th, 6th, I think, if that's in fact the weekend. And then 2 weeks after that would be the final round. So the application process is open at least through the 17th. Oftentimes someone late comes into the process and, you know, we would certainly consider that. But, you know, so far the quality of the candidates is excellent. And we're really excited about the type of people who want to be here in our community. And we're looking forward to this process.
Now, how many do you have so far?
I don't know the exact number, but we have quite a few. I mean, it's substantial and they come from all over the country, every geographic region, including in the state of Utah. But, you know, as far away as Connecticut, a bunch of folks from California. I mean, they're kind of everywhere.
Yeah. And are we going to be able to have some transition time then between Superintendent Conley and the new superintendent?
It looks unlikely just based on the schedule that we have and the schedule that she has. She'll be ending her service in June. We would be making our hire right around then at the end of May, early June. And typically there's a period where our incoming superintendent would be giving notice to his existing district and helping them and not just leaving them, you know, at the drop of a hat. So, I think Superintendent Conley has been very willing to help transition, but it may not be both of them sitting in the same room at the same time. It may be a little bit over the phone and helping each other, but I don't think they're going to be sitting in the same place for an extended period.
Okay. And what about the high school principal? Is that down to the finalists or?
So that, that position was approved by the board last night. So an offer has been made, to a candidate. And we'll see where that goes. If the candidate chooses to accept, I believe he will. The interview committee was very impressed by this candidate. And as were a number of the teacher representatives who met with him from the high school. So that position will be filled, hopefully, very, very shortly.
An in-district applicant?
No, it is an out-of-district applicant.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, that's it from us.
Okay. Aaron, Andrew, thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
8:32 now. Good morning. Well, the Fairway Mortgage Park City branch hosting a 3-hour continuing education course for realtors to learn more about how to help our veterans get into homes. Also partnering with the American Worry Initiative to help raise money for the National Ability Center. In the studio to give us more details, I have Nanette Bush with Fairway Mortgage Branch and Katie Richens with the National Ability Center. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Nanette, let's start with you and just maybe why this is something that Fairway Mortgage wanted to get involved with.
Fairway Mortgage is a national mortgage company. We're licensed in all 50 states. We have a presence there. And we have a lot of loan officers nationally that do a lot of work with veterans and VA financing. It's a passion that is very close to Louise Thaxton's heart. She's one of our senior officers, and she and along with Sean Parnell, who is a veteran and New York Times bestselling author, have created the American Warrior Initiative to help loan officers understand the complexities and dispel some misnomers about VA financing. It's what we can do to give back to veterans for their service, and it's an entitlement that they have earned, and it's our duty to help them be able to utilize that. So it's important to be well-versed and understand the.
Okay, so this class is going to be offered when?
This class is offered tomorrow. It's a three-hour continuing education course for our local realtors. It's a Utah-approved continuing education class. They get Utah CE, and it helps real estate agents understand some of the financing options and complexities for VA loans.
Okay, where's that going to happen?
It will be at the National Ability Center here in Park City. And registration is at 8:30. The class goes from 9 to noon. Sean Parnell will be there. He'll be speaking, have copies of his books.
Okay. Talk maybe briefly just a little bit about some of the complexities. I mean, we have what are VA loans, and we've been dealing with those for 50, 80 years, no?
Right, absolutely. And VA loans, they are a government loan. They're insured by the Veterans Administration. They're guaranteed. It has in the past been a perception that they're hard to get, or they take a long time, or there are appraisal issues, and all of those are kind of old school folklore. VA loans are 100% financing available. And there's also a perception that here in Summit County and Park City in particular that we don't really have a need, but we really do. There is no loan limit in terms of the amount to finance. Veterans are allowed to borrow up to 100% financing with no down payment. So it's a tool that is underutilized. Up to 21% of all home financing is VA eligible, and we're just not seeing those kinds of numbers. So low interest rates, low down payment, no mortgage insurance required. It's a great tool.
And just kind of a heads up, because this upcoming season, Vail Resorts is offering its $99 military epic pass. So that's going to be, we're going to see, I think, a lot more military folks. And also the fact that we've got a military hotel that's being developed there at the base of Deercrest. So,
absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's just the market will only grow.
Right.
Yeah. Katie, let's just talk a little bit about the National Abilities Center's role in all of this. Again, as we had mentioned, Fairway Mortgage is partnering with this American Warrior Initiative, and you're the beneficiary of that?
Correct. By happen chance, we were able to sit down with Nanette and her incredible team with their interest in supporting our servicemen and women. I know many of your listeners here are familiar with the NAC and our efforts within our military service population. But one program in particular I feel that most are not aware of is a particular effort that's being taken in part with the National Center for Veteran Studies based out of the University of Utah. What truly is a staggering, groundbreaking introduction to tackling PTSD is a two-week treatment program that is combining psychotherapy, cognitive thought processing therapy, which is one of two approved treatments by the Department of Defense for the treatment of PTSD. This program is so revolutionary, and it is taking our servicemen and women who are diagnosed with PTSD out of a clinical setting, using a holistic, still clinical approach to tackling PTSD. Within 2 weeks, we are seeing over 76% of those leaving our program no longer with the PTSD diagnosis. They are, in a sense, being cured of their PTSD, and we are seeing these gains, these results, follow up for years after that treatment.
Wow. So talk a little bit about the protocol. I mean, what is it that you're doing?
It's a combination, again, with Dr. Craig Bryan, Craig and Annabelle Bryan out of NCVS, a combination of psychotherapy in the morning, recreational activities that are targeted towards some of those outcomes, and then a mixture of evening educational sessions that might focus on sleep, relaxation, mindfulness. We're finding, again, these incredible results with a combination of that, which is so unique about this program is that it's not only for the veterans to come participate. We are inviting and asking for the entire family to join. Again, we know that not only that veteran is going away and serving and sacrificing, but the entire family back at home is also sacrificing. And it's an opportunity for them to heal and to bond together throughout the change in their parent.
Okay. So the deal is that you're hoping to raise the money in order to bring about 24 of those. So you'd have three separate sessions.
Correct.
Of eight. Yeah.
Well, currently we're running about three of these cohorts, three of these studies a year. We'd love to see that number increase. Within each study, we've got about the bandwidth for treating specifically 8 veterans per retreat. AWI and Fairway Mortgage was blown away by some of the effects that were coming out of that program and wanted to put their hand into supporting and continuing that effort and ensuring that our men and women are getting the continued service that they need.
So how is the fundraising all part of this?
So the fundraising is coming from a couple of different directions. All of the proceeds for this continuing education class, it's a $30 registration for realtors. All of the proceeds will go directly to the fundraising effort. We're also looking for donations from community members to help support this. And we've got some sponsors, local businesses that have participated. Our goal is to raise $20,000, and that will fund one of the workshops and bring 8 veterans and their families to the community and participate in the program. So we're short of our goal at this stage. We've raised about $6,000, but we're hoping to have additional participation with realtors coming for the continuing education piece. They get 3 hours of CE, and it's a great cause.
Yeah, like I say, I mean, those realtors, if you're out there, mm-hmm. this would be a great time to get the information you need, because it's just going to get bigger from here.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And then the people, is there something online that people donate to, or how does that work?
Yeah, so you can find us on Facebook, Fairway Independent Mortgage Park City. If you search that on Facebook, the event will come up. You can click on the event. It will launch an option to donate. It will offer an option to register for the class. Or if you're interested in sponsoring, you know, we can get some marketing material for local businesses that are participating. So, but probably the easiest way would be the Fairway Independent Mortgage Facebook page.
Okay. And then this Sean Parnell, the author,
mm-hmm.
he'll be doing something separately, or that's part of the education?
So after the education piece and the classwork is completed, Sean Parnell will speak. He does about a 20-minute presentation. He's an author. He scripted Outlaw Platoon, which is a fantastic, really, really good read about his time in Afghanistan. He was an Army Ranger. So he'll give his 20-minute keynote speech, and then we do the presentation of the funds raised to the NAC for their program, and anyone in the community is invited to that. That you don't have to register. If you're a veteran, we would love to have you come and honor your service and show our appreciation. So it's open to the community, but you know, we're taking any donations. Our Bunko group raised over $100 and as part of the contribution. So, yeah, we're looking for some support.
Okay, that'll happen at noon then, the presentation and the speech.
Yes, noon at the Ability Center.
Okay, ladies, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thanks, Leslie.
Annette Bush and Katie Richens. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:42. Well, Utah Symphony has announced its 2018 Deer Valley Music Festival lineup this week, featuring 17 shows from June through August. On the phone with me, I have Paul Meacham. He's Utah Symphony Opera president and CEO, and in the studio, one of the founding donors of the Deer Valley Music Festival, Joanne Schubler. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Paul, just real briefly, we're reporting this morning on Deer Valley's resort decision not to renew the contract for the Park City Institute. I'm guessing you're feeling pretty good that your contract was renewed, huh?
Well, you know, we have a long relationship with the resort, and, you know, it's a mutually very beneficial relationship. And, you know, the festival has grown over the years with the resort support, so we're very happy that you know, we love the venue. The orchestra adores playing in such a beautiful setting. So, yeah, I mean, we're thrilled that we continue to perform at the Snow Park Amphitheater.
Yeah, and as Joanne, as I kind of mentioned, I mean, you're one of the founding donors of the festival, you and other families as
yes.
well. But talk to me just a little bit about why that was something that you and others thought that this was important to get behind, bring the symphony to Deer
Valley. It's been 15 years already, which is very difficult to believe.
But when we were first approached about this concept, it just seemed like such a wonderful thing to bring world-class music to the community in such a world-class venue. The ties between Deer Valley and the symphony and occasionally some opera performances as well. The Utah Symphony has had a many-year history performing at the venue prior to the beginning of the festival. And so I think that was the continuation on a much broader basis that existed prior to the beginning of the festival.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, it spans 6 weeks. We're talking about 17 concerts, but not all at Deer Valley. You also use the St. Mary's Catholic Church there, Paul?
That's right. It is one of the most perfect venues for small orchestral music. We love playing there. The acoustics are perfect. It's a great size, about 450 seats, so everyone feels close to the performers. And, we'll be doing four concerts there on our traditional Wednesday evening slot.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the highlights then of the outdoor shows. I think the big one here, of course, Christian Chenoweth, huh?
Well, we're thrilled to have her back. She's such a superstar and was a huge hit when she was here a few years ago. So we're thrilled that she's agreed to come back.
All right. What are some of the other highlights that you'd like to focus
well,
on?
Well, I think, variety being the spice of life, we've got, got a great spread of things. We've got our traditional staples like the opening concert on June 30th, which is the Patriotic Pops. And then towards the end, we have our traditional Tchaikovsky evening, although this time the 1812 Overture, which is a huge favorite. We're doing a extended version of it with chorus, and that's going to be really very special with the cannoneers of the Wasatch doing the cannons towards the end of the piece. But some of the new things, we've got wonderful folk rock blues singer who's now performing with the orchestra, Amos Lee. We have a legendary bluegrass performer, Ricky Skaggs, with his band Kentucky Thunder. We've got an 80s Australian rocker. We probably all remember Jesse's Girl, Rick Springfield. Then we have, we've got some wonderful music of Stephen Sondheim and Andrew Lloyd Webber from their musicals, an evening of that. We've got fantastic music of ABBA the concert. Everyone's being encouraged to dress up or get out those platform heels from 25 years ago, whenever. We're finishing off with the music of Pink Floyd, which is really very orchestral in nature, and so it's a really good fit for working with the symphony. That's just a selection. It really is a wide variety of different styles and genres. It just kind of shows the orchestra in different guises, from classical to pop to rock to bluegrass. It's it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think that Pink Floyd, that's a great choice there. I think that would be very interesting to hear it done by the symphony. How do you know, though, what singers, I mean, Kristen, you've got some experience with, but when you bring out Rick Springfield and Ricky Skaggs and Amos Lee, I mean, how do you know that they're going to fit well with the symphony?
Well, that's a great question. some of these artists have a history within Utah. They may have played at other venues in Utah. If not, we just look at if they've performed in other outdoor venues, how they performed in other places. But at the end of the day, there's always a little bit of – that's part of the excitement. It's more an art than a science. You'd never quite know if an artist is really going to click with audiences here or not. But we feel pretty confident that everyone that we've invited this year is going to be a big hit.
Okay. Real quick, I know you wanted to mention a summer Barn Bash gala. That's going to happen in August. We could talk to you more about that at some other time. But Joanne or Paul, who wants to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I'll start it. Joanne wants to chip in. It is the 15th anniversary, and we decided you can't pass on an anniversary without some kind of celebration. We decided to do something a little different, which is to have what we're calling a Barn Bash at Blue Sky. on August the 9th. And it's there's a wonderful country group called Asleep at the Wheel, which is the main act. And it'll be a dinner, music, and we're raising money for the Symphony and the Opera's education programs across the state. So it's both a great evening and also a fundraiser for our education programs, and that's on August the 9th.
Okay, and then Joanne, can you tell us about we always do a local sale for Park City and Summit County residents?
Yes, that has always been extremely successful, and it gives the residents of our community the opportunity to buy discounted tickets in advance so that they are guaranteed of their seats. That sale is Saturday, March 31st, 3 o'clock until 5 o'clock in the afternoon at the Park City Visitor Center at Kimball Junction, and that is on Olympic Parkway. So we invite all of you who are listening to come, bring your friends, bring your family, and support the Deer Valley Music Festival.
Okay. Do you have to buy a certain number to get?
Right. There's a minimum of four concerts for packages until single tickets open on April 17th. So we encourage people, you get a priority if you book a package of four or more until April 17th when tickets go on sale to the general public.
Okay, but the tickets will go on sale to Summit County residents on the 31st,
right.
And you'll just need to show ID, I'm guessing.
You got it.
Okay. Well, again, it sounds like an exciting season. If people want more information, they can find it at deervalleymusicfestival.org. Paul and Joanne, thanks for your time this morning.
Oh, our pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
KPCW News Time now, 8:53. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Summit Arts Council on Friday presents Blank Canvas, an unexpected creative experience. In the studio to tell us what it is, I have the director of the Arts Council, Hadley Dynack, along with community manager Jocelyn Scudder. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, I mean, maybe Jocelyn, you can just kind of give us some of the details. What's happening Friday?
Definitely. So it's on Friday. The event is from 7 to midnight, and it's actually kind of sectioned off into two events throughout the night. So from 7 to 9, there's our performance showcase, and then from 9 to midnight, it's our pop-up dance party. And so it's an unexpected creative community experience. The dress code is to wear white, and it's going to be a transformed space. There's going to be interactive art, surprise performances, music, and dancing. And so the idea is for everyone to come express their inner palette with us for an evening that they won't want to miss.
Okay, what's the wearing white part of this? Are you going to have black lights? Is that it? Or
well, you know, the theme is blank canvas. And, you know, for our first Culture Club event, which we'll get into what that is in a little bit, but, you know, it's a metaphor for starting something new. White is the perfect palette for our first event like this. And so it's kind of just reinforcing our blank canvas theme. And it's always fun to play dress up too.
Okay. And how much are tickets?
So tickets are $75 for the performance portion from 7 to 9 and $20 for the 9 to midnight portion for the pop-up dance party. We wanted to make sure we had two price points, make it accessible for everyone. Hopefully it'll be really fun.
So live music then for the 9
we'll
to midnight?
We'll have a DJ.
A DJ,
yep.
Okay.
Yep, and we have a really great set planned.
Okay, so Hadley, maybe you can talk a little bit about why you're doing this. I mean, is it a fundraiser or is it just to get you out there?
Absolutely, yeah. So this event started out as part of something called Culture Club, which Jocelyn just mentioned, which is a new pilot major donor program that the Arts Council has launched to diversify some of our revenue streams. As one of the benefits of being a Culture Club member, the Arts Council has promised a series of unexpected creative events. So that's kind of the theme of this program. And when we partnered with Park City Events and The Yard, we realized that for this first event called Blank Canvas, we realized that we had the capacity to open it up to the larger community. So we wanted to take that and extend the offerings to everybody that wants to participate in this kind of transformative blank white evening.
Okay, so what's the performance portion of it? I mean, what's going to happen those first couple of hours?
So good question. Mm-hmm. And as we've been saying, and we don't mean to be elusive, but the whole kind of intention of Culture Club is this notion of unexpected. Mm-hmm. And so we're programming some surprise performances. You really won't want to miss them. I think they're going to be pretty transfixing and engaging. And those will happen in that 7 to 9 range. So if you do come for that part, please plan to stay for the pop-up dance party. That ticket price goes through midnight. I think we're going to leave it at that, unless you want to add anything, Jocelyn.
No, I don't. We do want to keep it a surprise.
Okay. I mean, how many things are going to happen?
Well, let's see. Can I put a number to it? 3 to 4, maybe 5.
Okay.
There will be some interactive art as well that's going to be featuring a local artist who we will not reveal at this time, but people will know this person. It's exciting.
All right. And then this Culture Club, this is kind of the membership portion of all of this. So do you need to be a member of Culture Club to be part of the performance portion of this?
No, absolutely. Culture Club members receive a code, gratis opportunity to come. But like I said, we have the space and it's going to be really a fun night. So we decided to take advantage of it and open up to everybody.
Okay. People want more information. What can they do?
Go to pcscarts.org/blank. We also have event details on Facebook. So if you just search Blank Canvas, it should come up.
Okay. Again, Park City Summit Arts Council presenting Blank Canvas this Friday night at the Yard starting at 7. The $20 party starts at 9. Everyone's welcome.
Absolutely.
Hey, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.